Marcy Zoroff coined the term and pioneered the market for eco fashion and is an internationally recognized eco lifestyle entrepreneur, educator, and expert who keynotes globally on organic, sustainable textiles, strategic creative vision, social innovation, green business design, and the rise of the millennial generation. Yes, she is all that. In her spare time, she has written a book, Eco Renaissance, a lifestyle guide for co-creating a stylish, sexy, and sustainable world. Marcy helps people understand that gone are the days of the boxy hemp skirts, and here are the days of innovation and making ecology as stylish and sexy as red carpet fashion. Marcy is the change that I wish to see in the world. So stay with me as I tap into Marcy's brilliance, her enthusiasm, and her knowledge about all things sustainable and beautiful. I'm quite certain she will inform and delight us and leave us all with a sense of eco-renaissance principles to live by. Excited? I know I am, and I know that you can hear it in my voice. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to the Year of Living Consciously, 2019. That's a tagline that Mrs. Green's World will be using very consistently. Let's all hope that we see record numbers of people waking up and getting engaged in significant ways to help preserve this great planet of ours, knowing that according to climate scientists around the globe, we've got about 12 years literally to get our act together and turn this ship around big time. I can assure you all that our team will be doing our part to continue our work as disruptors for good. We want to shake it up. So thank you all for being a part of it and for being on this journey with us. Let's make good things happen together. And now please joining me, such a perfect guest for that message, and our guest for this hour, Marcy Zoroff. Marcy is truly, authentically an eco-dynamo. And all that that implies, she is indeed an internationally recognized eco-lifestyle visionary, authority, innovator, and educator, and has been instrumental in driving authenticity, environmental leadership, and social justice worldwide for nearly three decades. And you know that I always comment, I woke up about 10 years ago, and I wanted everybody else to start waking up with me. Well, Marcy woke up 20 years before I did. I'm so pleased to have you here, Marcy, and I think you know, or at least I hope you know, that I'm one of those people you influenced and you helped put the environmental and social justice of the fashion industry on my radar a long time ago.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be coming full circle and co-creating with you because your message to kick off the show was perfectly in line with everything I believe and what my book is all about.
And it's what you're all about. And I sometimes wonder, like, who's watching Mrs. Green's World? And I'd love to know, well, you can know that Mrs. Green's World is watching you. And it matters because then it enhances and improves our message. And I really thank you for that. So there are so many ways to start this conversation, but I decided to start with a big one, a whopper, if you will. And I never play stump the guest, so don't get nervous, but you've been involved with this movement for over three decades. And what I'd like to know is what you do and what it matters. What kind of problem are you trying to solve and how are you going about solving it? It's a big question, and you have consistently shown up to show us the way.
Yeah, so I could just say that, you know, my mission has always been to make the norm the alternative and the alternative the norm, right? So when I started, you know, 30 years ago, that was a pretty daunting task considering that anybody who was into things like organic food or conscious living were considered the fringe or, you know, the hippies or, you know, we were all swimming upstream trying to convince people that what we believed made sense. And, you know, it's on a very deep intuitive level, I believed it's not an if, it's a when people wake up. So, you know, I'm thrilled to see the way this lifestyle has now crossed into the mainstream where you can honestly say there is a new normal out there today in the world of popular culture there still is a lot of resistance. I mean, we're living in a modern day Star Wars, but there's enough people who have, drank the Kool-Aid.
Sometimes I wake up and I say, where am I? Like, it can't be planet Earth because this is not really happening in my space. But before we get into a discussion about the book, share with us just where the fashion industry ranks in terms of its harmful impact on the planet and on millions of its inhabitants. What is that? What does that picture look like?
Yeah, like a lot of people don't realize that the fashion industry, if you include kind of all aspects and, you know, agriculture, transportation, is actually the second largest polluter in the world, second to coal. And 10% of the world's carbon impact or carbon footprint is coming from the fashion industry. 20% of the world's freshwater pollution is actually coming from textile treatment and dyeing. And, you know, when you start to pull the curtain back and look at the social and environmental impacts of fashion from, you know, the amount of water that's being used, the amount of energy that's being used, the amount of chemical use, waste is, you know, over 5% of the world's landfills are just textile waste. I mean, in America, the average American is throwing away almost 70 pounds of clothing a year. And then you look at, you know, the social impact and the fact that farmers and workers have just been crammed down by, you know, retailers and brands looking for bigger margins, and the people that, you know, that's at the expense of, you know, the people who are growing and selling our products where they can barely sustain their livelihoods.
Huge, all that that implies. And we're going to get into a little bit your passion about changing the cotton industry a bit later in the show. But when you think about it, one of the things we have in common as human beings, at least most of us, is we all wear clothes. And that's huge. Think of the impact and all that it implies. So along those, that vein, that train of thought, you have had a long journey in the eco space. Why the book Eco Renaissance Now? What made you say, okay, now's the time, I'm really busy, it's a lot of work, but I want to give people tools to help move them forward and really fuel this movement? Why it? Why now?
Yeah, so, you know, be careful what you wish for, right?
Indeed.
So I would say that, you know, I've been talking about the lifestyle concept for most of my career, right? I co-founded, you know, the school in New York in 1990 that is known today as the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, which has certified over 75,000 people as health coaches. I discovered very quickly there was an interconnection between food and beauty, and became, you know, best of friends with the founder of Aveda, Horst Reckelbacher, who actually wrote the foreword to my book, Eco Renaissance. So we connected the dots there. And then it was, you know, I stumbled upon the idea of fashion being yet another lifestyle choice that is also interconnected. And that's when I coined the term eco fashion in 1995. When people thought I was absolutely crazy, because it made sense to me that you can't really support one part of the wellness equation without the others, that they're all very much interrelated in both agriculture and consumer products in the minds and eyes of the consumer. So why now? Well, I think the internet has changed the game. I think that you have a generation of people like my kids that have grown up where they can pull the curtain back and they can ask questions like, you know, where did my food come from and what's in it and who made my clothes and, you know, how is it being made? And because they can get those answers by just, you know, Googling and starting to do research online and, you know, have that information available as we did not, it's changed everything in the way of transparency. And so my book is really, you know, addressing that there's all these people now where that seed of consciousness is getting planted because of social media and networking, and they get it, they see it, they hear about it, but yet, you know, it's scary and they don't know what, you know, to look for, and they don't know where to find these kinds of products, and they don't know what to believe. And so, you know, my book is really a way to take people on this very user-friendly, fun, sexy, and cool journey. So, you know, to demonstrate that it's all about no compromise. It's not about deprivation or giving something up or sacrifice. It's about getting more and getting added value in the choices you're making and empowering people to vote with their dollars.
And I just want to comment on the book, and I never, ever give out false praise because my standards continue to get higher. But people ask me all the time, What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? How do I know what to do? And what I'm going to say now is I have a great book for you because it's instructive. It tells people how to. And I was trying to think about how I would describe the book because it's part philosophy, it's part education, it's part inspiration, and it's definitely part how to. This is what you can do. Here's the deal. But it's not like reading a chapter book. You have to put it down, think about it, go back to it, underline things. And I'd like to dive into the book. And I think you're going to think my first question is rather strange, but it is me. And that means I might be rather strange. But what got me, you know,
that's a good thing.
It's like, no kidding, normal is so overrated. But I'm a big Rumi fan. So strangely enough, I'd like to start with a quote in the very beginning because I have used it. I sent it to my daughters. I have written it on a piece of paper because it had me from hello, and that matters to me with a book. And here's the quote. Do you know what you are? You are a manuscript of a divine letter. You are a mirror reflecting a noble face. The universe is not outside of you. Look inside yourself. Everything that you want, you are already that. So it stopped me in my tracks. I'm trying to not sound emotional, even though I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Let's cry more. So obviously impactful for me. Why that quote to greet someone as they enter into the eco-renaissance experience? How did you pick that one?
Well, you know, it truly embodies what the eco-renaissance movement is all about. You know, we're not physical beings in a spiritual world. We're spiritual beings in a physical world. There's so much more, you know, beyond what we see. And there's so much more within us than there is, you know, outside of us. And I think, you know, it goes back to, you know, Rumi, there's no one better that has just, you know, been able so eloquently to voice, you know, messages of love and light and spirit and all the things that Rumi is about. And Horst and I shared that love. And since this book is dedicated to Horst, I thought it was the most apropos quote to use for so many reasons. This book is all about rebirth, and the word renaissance is rebirth, and it's to activate that light, come back to who we really are. It's a reminder that we're all part of an ecosystem, and that's why it's called eco-renaissance.
So fitting. So let's talk about Horst for a minute. Horst Reckelbacher, he is the founder of Intelligent Nutrients and the Aveda Corporation. He wrote a very powerful foreword for the book before he died in 2014. And again, you know, I could have done this first interview on the first 20 pages of the book because I'm like writing and I'm making yellow stickies and ask her this and ask her that. But there are many quotable quotes in his foreword, but one in particular did jump off the pages for me. And it was, eco-renaissance is grounded in spreading the message of how we all benefit from collective action. To me, that is the truth spoken into word. What in your book helps us understand this, and why is it so vitally important that we do understand the power of collective action?
Well, for one thing, and this is was the inspiration to my first company called Under the Canopy, my first sustainable fashion and home brand. We all live under the canopy of this planet's ecosystem together. We're all in this together. You know, we all have heard about the butterfly effect and the fact that, you know, look, at the end of the day, what we do here, you know, it might not, you know, translate tomorrow, but at the end of the day, when you look at what's going on with climate change, this is not, you know, just happening across the world where there are, you know, heavily polluted industries like in China and in India. This is happening in our own backyard. But it's a collective responsibility that we all have, all hands on deck, to start to mitigate climate change. Or as you said at the beginning of the show, you know, we have 10 to 12 years left to really reverse this damage. So it's serious. This is the greatest threat to humanity in the history of humanity. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think the idea of collective action is in the spirit of serving others is really serving ourselves. We're all, you know, we're all interconnected on every level. Think of us as, you know, I have a channel named Bashar that I love, and he put it really well once. He said, you know, it's like, think of Humpty Dumpty, you know, in its full form, and then, you know, falling off the wall and splintering into lots of pieces. But really, if you put all those pieces back together, it's Humpty Dumpty. Well, you know, this idea of we are one, you know, think of us as all those different pieces, but we are all part of this, you know, this interconnected all of life, you know, the nature, the environment, you know, all living species and humans are all interconnected. And just to end with, you know, in the sense of that symbiotic relationship that we have with our environment is so paramount to the book's underlying DNA that, you know, we breathe out carbon dioxide and the plant kingdom breathes it in, and the plants and oceans breathe out oxygen and we breathe it in. You know, that interdependence is very, very real. And we can't destroy our home and this relationship, or ultimately we're really risking our own futures.
And, you know, from what I see, this challenge is a global challenge, especially among climate scientists. I feel and see, like, for attending the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco a couple of months ago, scientists are understanding their part in not being able to provide an integrated thought process for people. They live in silos, and I think that they are understanding, as a global community, we've got to put this message together so that it's relatable and relevant to people's lives and not just science speak, and why it matters so much for them to get their messages to us that we all indeed live under the canopy. It was one of, I'll never forget it when I read about your company, and I think it had to be 9 or 10 years ago when I first started. I might have even been on terrestrial radio then, but Under the Canopy, I wish that I had named my radio show that, but you took it instead of me getting it. It's like we want to really rebrand, because what is Mrs. Green's World? It felt like a good idea at the time, but there's a time, you know, that's a story for another day, but Under the Canopy says it all. We all live under the canopy. What happens under the canopy impacts it all. And that was, to me, so visionary on your part. So Eco-Renaissance is really not a book. It is a book, but it's a movement. It's not a book that you read and put on the shelf, as I said. And every movement has its fundamental principles. And you have certainly thought that out. You've outlined 5 elements of the Eco-Renaissance movement. Can you share with us briefly what they are and why these concepts are the backbone of the rebirth? Because they are. I sat there trying to think, did she forget anything? And I couldn't come up with one thing. She's got it covered under the canopy.
Yes. And, you know, and if you think about it, even with the rainforests of the world, you know, there is more life living under the canopy of the planet's rainforests that are producing the oxygen, 50% of the oxygen, actually, that we need to breathe. So
right.
It's also very, very powerful when it relates back to the rainforest. And also Native American tradition would say that if we, you know, we need to protect our canopy or we risk life in future generations. So very, very much relevant. And the book, the 5 C's of this movement, as you said, really to me are the DNA or the pillars that weave through all of our popular culture sectors that define this movement. And so those 5 C's are creativity, consciousness, collaboration, connection, and community. And the book dives into, once I get through the introduction and forward, it looks at food, wellness, beauty, fashion, and business, which are really the 5 kind of main areas of popular culture. And so what I do is I kind of look at what those common themes are that make for an eco-renaissance. So when you're thinking about, you know, each of those areas of your life, you know, how is this world different? And so creativity is where it all starts, because at the end of the day, we are all creators, right? Every one of us. And, you know, as Albert Einstein said, and 2 of my favorite quotes are from him. One is that creativity is intelligence having fun. And the other one is that
I loved that one. I remember reading that. It's like, indeed.
Yeah, and the other one is, you know, we can't solve today's problems with the same consciousness that created those problems. So now it's time that we recreate or we redesign a new way of living, being, and thinking. And that is at the core of the book, that through the lens of design and creativity, we actually can change the world because we can create whatever reality we want. You know, vision is the art of seeing things invisible, right? That's Jonathan Swift quote. You know, we have the ability to design a new reality. And so that is absolutely like the aha of the book. And what that means is, you know, all of those sectors, food, fashion, beauty, business, art, and wellness, you lead with great design. As Horst always said, take people, you know, down the rabbit hole by first appealing to them at a very visceral level, you know, through art, inspire them visually, you know, through food, inspire them through taste, through fashion, inspire people through style, you know, through beauty, through scent and functionality, you know, and business profits, right? Those are kind of the fundamentals in design. Then you layer in fair trade, ethically made, responsible, organic, plant-based, sustainable, you know, and all those other pieces that add value. And so that's kind of where it starts. Yep.
No, and there's something for everyone. And I think that's right. The wheel that you created of culture change and all of those spokes, we're interested, engaged with, or a part of some, if not all of them. That's how I felt. It's like, yep, she's got it covered. And that's the world in which we live. And one of my favorite chapters in the book was actually chapter 7, consciousness and conscious business and consumerism. And it's because, as you wisely state, every topic you explore in the book comes down to changing business models and expanding our power as consumers. Everything we buy affects other people's lives. And I know that you know that. Means everything. So give us a sense for what you cover in this chapter and why it's such a vital takeaway, at least from where I sit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, you know, the idea of voting with your dollars is not something to be taken lightly. I mean, we see what politics, where politics has led us, right?
Right.
So, you know, I think what's happening even in the climate change story now is that business is stepping up because business is a much more powerful force for change than government, as we can see. And, you know, our ability now to stay on track with, you know, the Paris Climate Accord and commitments that, you know, we as a nation would still like to see happen are going to come from the business world, not from government, right? So, you know, I think we have to start small and not be overwhelmed by getting from point A to point Z overnight as consumers. You know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step.
Totally.
So take baby steps and read labels and learn about the companies and the products and the, you know, brands that you're supporting and, you know, and join those brands and those movements and don't just, you know, buy a product for the sake of a product. You know, look at what other value you can get from that and be informed and think about, you know, think about things in terms of the long-term impacts and the cradle-to-cradle approach, which is what we take from the earth, we need to give back to the earth. You know, this is no longer, we got to get out of the mindset that we live in a linear world, that there's unlimited resources, because there aren't. And we have to start thinking about a circular economy, you know, that this cradle to cradle, you know, we measure things like material health and reuse and renewable energy and social justice and water stewardship. These are all really important tenets of good products today. So then I talk really about, you know, my favorite thing that I've been saying for decades, which now you hear, you know, more regularly, is this idea of the 5 P's, right, in business, which is people, planet, profit, passion, and purpose. That, you know, we're looking at new forms of governance in business. It's not just about the bottom line anymore. In fact, the rise of the B Corporation movement is huge. There's over, I think, 2,500 B Corps now. And that's all about a new form of governance in business where you measure the impacts to people and planet in addition to profit. So it's about, you know, it's about looking at that ethical profit as, you know, and all of the tenets of good business that we can do well by doing good.
And it so matters. And when you say it inspires me, the B Corp is a perfect example. And to see its growth, it's really increasing significantly and big companies are stepping up. It's harder to be a B Corp if you're really, really big, but companies are taking it on and proudly. So what are your thoughts on voting with our dollars versus impacting public policy? Do we need to be focusing on both? And if you don't mind, I'd love to tell you a very quick story about, it's very personal. So all of us have things we're proud of along this journey, things we're doing right, things that we would love to not show up on Twitter. Like if I drive through an In-N-Out Burger with a disguise on once every 4 months, it's like, I hope nobody sees me because I don't want to be in a fast food restaurant and I don't want to be eating meat, but I do. And everybody, I think everybody has those hidden pleasures or guilty pleasures or whatever. But about a month ago, my daughter, who has adapted and adopted in so many significant ways, all my kids have, she still held on to Static Guard. And she sprayed it on some clothes. And I said to her, you know, Katie, when did Static become a moral lapse? You don't need that. We work together well. And she smoothed out the piece of clothing that she put it on. And Marcy, then she just like rubbed to get her bangs out of her eyes and rubbed her hand down her face. And within about, I don't know, 30 seconds, she started breaking out in this horrible rash. And it was ugly. And it was everywhere her hand touched. So then, of course, we both went down the rabbit hole of research. And it does relate to my policy question. The contents, the ingredients in Static Guard are banned in Europe, which you know is consistently the story. We take their garbage and put it in our skincare products. Like, oh, Europe doesn't want it. Let's put it in our face cream. So where does, and to me, that product, I don't expect every consumer to know that. It's got really awful, and I can't even find a better word. Like, it's egregious what they are allowed to put in a can and sell. And if it gets near a baby or a child or if it gets in your eyes, it's disgusting. Where does public policy fit in on this? And it's hard for me sometimes. Should I be focusing on my voting power by my what I'm purchasing, or should I be working to get some of these things outlawed? And you have a much bigger sense of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it's a great question, and it's not one or the other, it's both, because 1 + 1 = 11. We need to be, pursuing changes in laws, because there is such a misconception out there from consumers that, well, if the government is regulating it and it has accepted that this is okay, then it's got to be okay for me, right? Like, I can buy beauty products that are on the shelves of major mass merchants because they wouldn't be there if the government thought they were bad for me. Little do they know that there are thousands of toxic chemicals in the beauty products and personal care products that people are using that, you know, are not being regulated and are very harmful to us and that have been banned in countries like, you know, Europe, throughout Europe. And so it is, it's very real. It's in our cleaning products. It's in our beauty products. It's in our fashion products. It's in our food products. And I think the starting point is people just have to start there and know that that's true. And then it becomes, you know, the way you vote with your dollars is really this idea that, you know, you have to think for yourself, like know what you're buying, what you're putting on your skin, what you're putting in your body, because it's all energy. And right, you know, you hear what you are, what you eat, but you're also, every choice that you make is a part of you. You know, it's an extension of you. The skin is the largest organ in the body and the primary organ for absorption, which is one of the reasons that it makes sense that beauty products and textiles, which we put on our products, on our bodies almost every single day, or I should say every single day, you know, that these things matter too. It's not just you are what you eat. It's not just what you put in your body that matters, you know? So I think when you think about policy, and I'm on the board of directors of the Organic Trade Association, which really is the lead trade organization of the $50 billion U.S. organic industry, and we have about 9,500 members. We do a lot of policy work, and I actually love the policy work because you have to have boots on the ground to talk to government about, you know, why organic matters, not just from an environmental social level, but it's actually an unbelievable good business case where you have an industry that's been growing at double-digit rates for almost 20 consecutive years, where there's more demand than there is supply, and you've got, you know, 83% of Americans today eating organic products. organic foods, at least occasionally. The biggest buyer in the country today is Costco. You know, it's no longer Whole Foods.
Right. It was huge when they came on board. Huge.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all the growth in the food world today across the multinational companies, the supermarket chains, the mass market retailers like Walmart and Target. I mean, everybody is getting on the train of organic now. And that's because consumers have spoken that this is what they want. 52% of organic shoppers today are millennials. And it goes back to what I said. Millennials are growing up in a new generation of, you know, information access, which is only going to continue to, you know, get the transparency model is only going to get, you know, more believable, more credible, because you have blockchain and technology, you know, coming soon. And so, you know, it's a new day today where I don't think that the old school ways can continue. Business as usual can't continue because people are waking up. And so those, they really do go hand in hand. But I think the laws are going to lag behind. But at the same time, they are important. And, you know, what's changing the power of government shift is collaboration. And I think that also can be attributed to technology and social media. And, you know, look at the way that consumers are speaking up now about what they want. And so, you know, I think we have this incredible asset today that, you know, you and I have been in the sustainability movement for a long time. You know, today, the fact that, you know, there are these tools out there, you know, that can absolutely amplify our voices on every level, are just going to really change the sustainability conversation.
And I have one more question before I go in. I'd love you to go into, dive a little deeper into your passion for improving the way we farm cotton, because it's huge, and talk to you about why. But before we go there, when people ask me, what can I do? Gina, what can I do? It's so overwhelming. What's the solution? What's the solution? Especially over dinner. And I say, well, you know, I wish I had the solution. There's not a solution. But my first solution is always educate girls and you'll change the world. That's what comes to me. It's a passion for me. And there's lots of reasons why. When I interviewed Paul Hawken, you know that that's one of his big solutions. It's in the top six, educate girls. And the other thing I say is, in the United States especially, we better learn how to reduce our consumption. That's what got us here. Where does that fit into your message? Because I know it matters to you, but how important a takeaway is that for our listeners and for people to read who read your book? Because the first R is reduce.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, and that issue transcends, you know, just buying products. It's actually also infused into, you know, our everyday lives in the way of food waste. And people don't even stop to think of the impacts of, you know, reducing even the need for all kinds of excess is, you know, it's going to make a big difference. And obviously, there's a lot of new business models around re-commerce. And, you know, I can speak to in fashion, they're one of the biggest areas of reduction in fashion consumption is in the form of the rental economy now.
Right.
You can
yes.
actually, you can,
yes.
I do. I happen to rent, you know, almost always when I travel, I rent my business clothes, my cocktail, you know, clothing, and once in a while, even my, you know, my everyday, more sportswear. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Rent the Runway, but there's also companies like the Renewal Workshop out there now where you can, you know, send back things that are broken, like a zipper that's broken, a button that's broken, and they will fix these things and so that it has a second life to it, which is amazing. And so there's definitely this whole circular economy movement in fashion is a big one. And whether it is, you know, repurposing things, or it is companies like The RealReal who are now going into people's closets and taking all of their, you know, good quality clothing and just cleaning it up and authenticating it and then reselling it as well. So a lot of opportunity to reduce consumption by knowing about these, you know, these other places that you can go to get your needs met. Like in the world of social media, people want fresh new looks and, you know, they don't want to wear the same thing all the time. But but, you know, this is a way that you don't have to buy it. You can actually, you know, rent it and give it back, or, you know, use it and give it back. And then there's a big movement also for swapping.
Yes.
There's a company called the Global Exchange. And, you know, there's a lot of clothes swapping going on out there. So it all comes down to, again, redesign of new business models in every one of these sectors.
And even the whole of resale, not retail, I love to get before a group in, I hope, fashionably dressed, because I have eco-fashionistas for daughters, and say, first thing I want to start off with, dress, Buffalo Exchange. Shoes, Buffalo Exchange. Scarf, Goodwill Industries Boutique. And when I was growing up, we didn't have a lot of money, and my mother was a savvy shopper, and we went a couple of towns over where it was, you know, much higher socioeconomic group, and we got lots of our clothes in thrift shops. And she would say, and rightly so, you don't have to tell people where you got it. And she taught us things like, look at this label. And I remember this, Marcy, Bergdorf Goodman. That means it's good quality. She didn't say it was status symbol. She said, this will last. And she taught us things about labels, not that they were expensive, but they were made to last. So I think now I can tell people, and I brag about it, and I think that's a really positive change, that resale. And I have had so many friends who rent a dress for a wedding. How smart is that? You never wear the dress again. People tell you that you're going to, but I think you're right. It's a big one. So
yeah.
It is, and it's fun. It's really fun.
I have a monthly account with Rent the Runway, so I get unlimited rentals. And I rent, like you said, I rent gowns from top designers. And you're right. Like who wears them again, right? So then you send them back right after. It's phenomenal.
I know, and I hope people go to MarcyZaroff.com and you'll get a picture for this vision of beauty that we're talking about. And I mean, it's beautiful from the inside out.
Thank you.
And I knew that from beginning. It's like, wow, she's got it all, and that's really a high compliment. So talk about cotton. It's such an important topic. It is so toxic. It is so dirty. How did this become a passion, and why do you continue to work to improve the lives of cotton farmers? Just take all the time you want, because it's a big one for me as well.
Yeah, so people finally get organic food, right? That, you know, it's free of harmful chemicals and pesticides and fertilizers or GMO seeds, that, you know, that we're looking at sustainable methods of agriculture, that we're building soil and protecting soil through things like crop rotation and cover cropping. We're not destroying and depleting and degenerating soil. And we're using soil ultimately as a solution to climate change, because when soil is healthy and filled with biodiversity, it becomes a sponge or a sink that captures carbon from the atmosphere. Now, the reason that we've moved so far away from, you know, we have part of the big reason for the climate impact that we have is we've destroyed soil all over the world. And so there is definitely now more than ever, and I'm a total soil junkie, there is a newfound attention to looking at soil again. Now I'm going to go backwards and I'm going to rewind to your question, which is just on a basic level, if you think about it, food and fiber crops, cotton being the number one fiber crop, are growing in agriculture side by side. You know, your cotton is, your clothing is not growing in the department store any more than your food is growing in the supermarket,
yes.
Right?
Where does your food come from?
Safeway. So all those sheets and towels and jeans and t-shirts and, you know, and athleisure wear or ready-to-wear clothing that's made from cotton, you know, it is starting right next to those food crops, right? So 60% of a cotton plant goes into our food stream in the way of feed for dairy and seed which is actually crushed into oil and made into cottonseed oil, which goes into tons of bread products, snack products that are lining our shelves, right? So now cotton is actually the most heavily sprayed industry in agriculture. And when you look at, you know, the magnitude and multitude of some of the worst, most carcinogenic chemicals. So, you know, you've got, I don't know, maybe 3% of the world's agriculture is cotton. but, you know, statistics show, you know, 15 to 20% of the most harmful pesticides, insecticides are being used on the cotton industry. So you've got, you know, you've got an industry that's really important to look at if we're going to be now, you know, rebuilding agriculture through organic food practices, right? And health and wellness because of the sprays. The farmers who are growing the cotton that we are wearing are often living in extraordinarily unsustainable conditions where they get stuck on what we call the pesticide treadmill, where they start spraying their crops and using the GMO seeds, and the bugs are building resistance. The pesticides are then getting stronger. So the cotton farmers are going out and taking loans from banks that are partnered with the pesticide and seed companies because they can't afford them. And so ultimately, over time, what's happening is that the bugs are getting out of control. The soil is getting destroyed. The crops are, you know, are not getting stronger and better. They're actually getting deteriorating. The farmers are going into despair from now these loans and this financial breakdown of the system. And many farmers are now committing suicide by actually drinking pesticides. In India, which is the largest growing region in the world, and is actually, cotton's the number one crop there, you know, you have a cotton farmer committing suicide almost every half hour. It's that serious. So I got my career in organic food and then moved into beauty. And when I started to learn about, you know, the social and environmental impacts of cotton, it just was like, wait, no, how come nobody knows this? And why can't we have organic cotton instead of conventional cotton that gives you everything you want from regular cotton, but then without all the toxic chemicals or the exploitation, the slave labor, and basically the destruction of agriculture, right? So I've been in the trenches for the last, you know, 25 years, really trying to build cotton, organic cotton farm projects, better the lives of the farmers. And I will tell you, it's like water for chocolate for me. It's like where I am just at my absolute happiest when I'm in these farms. And I know that the work I'm doing across the world, you know, buying, creating organic cotton bedding and bath products and apparel and accessories, and people are buying them because they love them. But people's lives across the world are really getting improving because of this, because we're paying fair prices to the farmers. We have a system that's sustainable. We are now building soil, which is building yields. And at the same time, we're not spraying all the harmful toxic chemicals. And then there's the processing of cotton. Just to add on to this, most people don't realize that, you know, you're told cotton is a natural fiber, right? So, you know, it's kind of like the old milk is a natural. And when you pull the curtain back on the regular conventional dairy industry, you see the hormones and antibiotics and steroids and all the things in factory farming. Well, when you pull the curtain back on cotton, you see chlorine bleach is added to cotton. And then when you get into the finishing and the dyeing, a lot of toxic chemicals are added, including sometimes things like formaldehyde or heavy metals. So when you have a GOTS certified, which stands for Global Organic Textile Standard, when you have a GOTS certified garment, that means the entire garment or the entire, you know, home textile has been certified from the farm to the finished product. So that means that not only is a cotton certified organic, just like if you were buying a certified organic food ingredient product, you also are looking at there's no harmful chemicals or finishes added in the processing of the cotton finished textile as well. And so don't just think just because it's organic cotton, you know, on the label, if it's not certified, that also could mean that it's, you know, heavily processed with a lot of toxic chemicals. And again, you know, going on our skin, people are wondering why they have allergies and asthma and, you know, 70 million people are walking around with asthma and allergies, right? And yet you think about it, you're wearing textiles 24/7 if you look at, you know, both the bedding and bath and the apparel. So it's a big one to look at. And I'm a huge advocate of connecting the dots from food to fiber, and especially because they are growing together in nature. And then going back to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, our first basic need is food, but our second basic need is shelter and clothing. I mean, that is everybody buys clothing, as you said from the beginning. So we actually can shift this you know, paradigm of, you know, conventional cotton to organic cotton, the same way we're now shifting, you know, our conventional food system into more of an organic food system.
And it's such an incredibly comprehensive and thoughtful response, and it just reinforces your commitment in the book and the threads that you have woven with the five C's. It is about connection. It is about community, and it is about consciousness. Not just know your farmer, know who farmed your clothes. And my grandkids I crack them up because I used to be that consumer that bought, oh, it's St. Patrick's Day, let's buy 5 t-shirts at Target for $5. And it's Valentine's Day, we could all have matching. And I would do it. And now I go in Target, not as much, and I say, don't buy that. It has the blood of children on it. My grandkids wait for that line, but it is about that connection. And that might sound a bit extreme, but as you know, not really. People are dying every day to put clothes on our backs, and it's not an exaggeration at all. But talk a little bit more about soil, because I'm a mini soil geek. I interviewed people from the Rodale Foundation twice, Maria Rodale being one of them. And I educated myself about why it's important that we don't saturate our soil with all of these things, other than the disastrous environmental impacts to us and our water supplies and our birds and our, you know, you name it, the butterflies. But soil, if it's organic, it uses less of everything. So tell us a little bit more. Inform us about why soil matters. It does start at the earth level.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the Rodale Institute, because they've been such amazing pioneers of this movement.
Totally.
And, you know, and just putting the message out there that, you know, healthy soil makes healthy plants, makes healthy people. And that's true. I mean, the soil is the skin of the earth, right? And as I spoke to, the skin being the largest organ in our bodies for, you know, absorption,
right?
The soil is meant to absorb, right? And so when it is dead soil, it's not doing its job to absorb the carbon that it should be absorbing, but it is absorbing, or what it has absorbed, unfortunately, is all the toxic chemicals that are used in conventional agriculture.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not even about sustaining agriculture anymore. It's about regenerating it. It's no longer about keeping it the way it is, because it's dead. It's degenerated. We have to now rebuild soil. We have to rebuild the balance in the soil, which makes for, you know, the better resilience, climate change resilience. It makes for better water retention. We have to build the biodiversity back into the soil, which, you know, a handful of good soil contains more microbes than there are humans on Earth, you know, in the form of things like bacteria and fungi, right? And then you have to have healthy soil that's free of toxins. And, you know, that is critical, because the soil is like the immune system. And if you grow plants, you know, in soil that is filled with toxic chemicals, that's going into the plants. It's systemic. Just like you can't pick an apple that's grown conventionally and just wash off the pesticides, because they're in the plant itself. They're in the tree. They're in the seed, you know, growing from the roots up. So we really have to think differently about, Native American wisdom. Another one of my favorite quotes is, we do not inherit this land from our ancestors. We borrow it from our children. What kind of world and land and soil are we leaving for our children? So there's a big movement right now for, you know, the regenerative agriculture movement, which is also, of course, you know, integrated with the organic agriculture movement. There are differences. Regenerative agriculture is really focusing on this climate change mitigation, as I spoke to, by building healthier soil that becomes this carbon sponge. We can all, using soil as one of our greatest solutions to climate change, which is real, by just rebuilding soil. There's a big movement for that. And of course, organic, you layer on, free of any toxic chemicals, pesticides, insecticides, or GMOs. And so they do go very hand in hand. And the ultimate agricultural movement is one that is regenerative and organic, which I speak to a lot in the book.
And speaking of the book, and I think you can always tell when I'm smiling, I'm like, bam, where did she get that quote? And sometimes, damn, how did she think of that? And that's absolutely authentic. So to that, you have one from Gandhi. Like, who doesn't love quotes from Gandhi? And it's like, it just nails it. There's no beauty in the finest cloth if it makes hunger and unhappiness. And unhealthy clothes are making our bodies unhappy. It's making the earth unhappy. And people are dying because of it. So if you want to get a bunch of quotable quotes, you can buy the book just for that. They're at the beginning of every chapter. And I'm like, okay, write that down. Little yellow sticky. Remember that, because there's a reason those quotes are timeless. So high praise for that one. And what I found out in this journey, which I'm sure you know, is that all of those things you mentioned, the pesticides, the fungicides, all of the fertilizers, if they're not natural, they go down when they're watered and they gather, they collect and form a block basically for water to do what it does. And that's why with golf courses and, you know, the malls on campuses, if they stop using them and use any type of natural or biodiverse product, which I know several, they use less water. So they cut down on their budget and they cut down on the water use. So it just makes sense all around. It makes business sense. It makes, you know, caring about the planet sense. It just makes sense overall. Okay, so what about this? And I struggled how to ask this question, and I hope I nailed it. But from where I sit, a key component of a truly sustainable planet is a socially just one, and I know that you agree with that. If people reading your book consciously decide to join you in this eco-renaissance movement, and obviously I hope they do, or I wouldn't have you here and I wouldn't be as passionate about the praise I have for the book, what are some of the potential positive impacts on the millions of people who can't even afford your book, let alone adopt many of the practices or purchase the products you recommend? What's the, what I call the ripple effect? And there definitely is one. What is your thought on that? How can all that you ask us to do embrace positive impact on their lives? Which, to me, it does, but I want you to answer that.
Yeah, no. And I want to just start by saying that one of my goals always in my career, not just with the book, has been to break the stigmas, okay? And the stigmas of an environmental movement, right? And that's why it's not about making fashion sustainable or food sustainable. You know, it's about making sustainability fashionable, making it people understand that, you know, this isn't this negative thing, right? Like my passion is to bridge, you know, the tribe and the boardroom, or the tree hugger and the fashionista, you know, very much like what you said, you know, we want it all. We want both, right? So, you know, it's the first big stigma is that you have to give something up, as I just spoke to. You have to give up style, quality, fit, taste, food, comfort, hand, scent. You have to give up the things you want, which is not true, right? It's about, you know, giving people what they love and seek while also making a difference to, you know, human environmental health and social and, you know, justice or farmer and worker welfare and future generations. The second stigma is you have to be rich to buy this kind of stuff, or you need a lot of money. And that's actually not true. And I want to point out that throughout the book, I give lots of ways that you can actually be a part of this movement if you don't have a lot of money. And whether that's, you know, joining a co-op where you contribute time, or you go to farmers markets, you know, where you can get organic and food, or you shop at CVS for your beauty products. This isn't about you have to go to Sephora. You know, this is all the mass merchants today, from Walmart up, they all have lots of good choices today. In fact, CVS has made a commitment to ban things like parabens from their own house brands in 2019. So, you know, this is accessible, and this movement has to be accessible. But then you've got companies like Thrive Market that actually are doing amazing work, where you're guaranteed 25% off of your organic and you know, healthier product choices, plant-based. It's kind of a Costco meets Whole Foods model, where you join as a member.
Yes.
But you get guaranteed 25% off everything. And their vision is to democratize, you know, organic and healthy products through an online, you know, experience. And then what they do is, you know, they because they live at this kind of intersection of the digital and good food revolutions, they are generating enough funds and engagement that they're giving back to low-income communities at the same time that they're also on a rocket ship of growth. So everybody's winning. And my favorite business model is all about win-win-win. You know, the consumer wins, the businesses win, and the people who are growing and sowing our products and making our products, you know, they're winning too, going back to, you know, the people who are at the bottom of the totem pole, literally or figuratively, you know, who are trying to just put food on the table. That goes back to what I said earlier. That's where I get so excited because I see how their lives are being bettered by us thinking differently about, you know, these kind of more fair trade, more organic, you know, more holistic systems at the consumer product level.
And just everybody listen to what Marcy said. And I want to reiterate, we've had wonderful guests from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and one of their studies was about how to eat healthy on a minimal budget. And you can. Don't buy the BS of eating organic is more expensive. It might mean that you can have a latte and certified organic kale. Pick the kale. And it's about everybody has a budget. It's deciding consciously how you are going to spend your money. And to me, are you going to invest in your health and the health of the planet or not? And it's a very clear path when you just ask that simple question. Is this going to make me sicker? Or, you know, it's a very selfish consciousness in some ways, in a good way. So let's talk about love. And the love economy. So many people that are thought leaders and corporate leaders and presidents of major corporations are having the courage more and more to talk about love. And you talk about it in your book. And again, another bam of a quote, work is love made visible by, I think it was it Khalil Gibran?
Khalil Gibran.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So... Mm-hmm. Talk about the love economy, because if ever we needed time, Marcy, for people to hear your message and read your book, do this instead of watching the nightly news so that you can learn about what is really happening, not about what the news is telling us, because you have so much data in your book about measurable progress in every industry, in the food industry, in the air quality industry, in the fashion industry, in the beauty industry. So why talk about the love economy?
So that quote, work is love made visible, is actually my number one favorite quote. And because what it really is saying is, if you love your work, it's not work, it's love. And I think one of the reasons we live in such a broken world is because people have two sets of values. They have their professional values and they have their personal values. And the things that you might not necessarily do with your family or, you know, want to see the people that you love, you know, things happen to them. People have just kind of disconnected from, you know, the choices that they're making and how those choices are affecting people across the world who are in this greater global family. And I think as people are waking up and they're realizing, wait a minute, that doesn't feel right. Wait, that doesn't make sense. I wouldn't, you know, it's the golden rule, treat others the way you want to be treated. I think what it really comes down to is people want to love, they want to be loved, they want to love what they do. And I think that's why, again, you're seeing this millennial generation waking up around passion and purpose, and they'd rather take a job that's purposeful and something they believe in than something that's just giving them a big paycheck. I mean, I've always said in my career, I feel like a little kid in a candy store because I get to do what I love, make a living, and change the world. Like, check, 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 sign me up for that, right? So the whole idea of this love economy is to reconcile our personal and professional values, to connect the dots, and to realize that when we follow our hearts, we're connecting to our livelihoods. You know, work is not a chore. It's something that we believe in, and love is that kind of secret ingredient to success. And most companies, when they hire people who, you know, love what they're doing, they see greater productivity, greater, you know, loyalty, greater commitment, a shared vision. And this has really been part of the secret sauce that's fueled companies like Whole Foods Market to success. is everybody's coming in with that shared, that common core values, that love, that they just all are looking for, you know, that sort of greater, the path to the greater good. And so, you know, I think when you fuse love into everything that you do, you start to find that you come more alive, you know? And I think I've seen it with so many people I know that have worked in conventional companies that just are like, I want to take my skill set and I want to do something that I believe in with that, which is why you have, you know, long lines of applications at companies like Patagonia and Eileen Fisher, right? Because people know that it's, you know, that those are companies they want to get behind. And I think it really does come down to, you know, love is that fuel at the core of who we all are. And it is that connective tissue. And so think of the power of love, right? And if we could all come from that place in everything that we do, here we go back to that collective consciousness shift. The you know, we would be elevating ourselves, and ultimately we're all part of that bigger picture. You know, the individual is, you know, the first step. First you find that love within yourself, but then contribute to that greater puzzle. And we can all, ultimately the goal is, just like fish swim together in schools and birds fly together, we want to thrive together as humanity.
And we are that. That is who we are as human beings. I mean, there's just no question about it. We've gotten so far removed just with our fences and our, and I don't mean the wall fence. People used to spend time on their front porch. I mean, the connection and lack thereof has occurred over time. So I have to tell you funny part of reading the book. I had many funny moments reading this book, and I'm glad some of them were not caught on video. So I'm reading along, and I've had an incredible year from around last October to this year. I got to go to the rainforest again, which is where my journey began. I got to go with people from Pachamama. And then I got invited to their global summit and spent time with Lynn and Bill Twist. And who shows up on the pages of your book? John Perkins! Oh, my goddess. I'm like, this dude is, he's like, you just want to follow him around. He's probably one of the smartest human beings.
I love John.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I love John,
too. He's a very
good
friend of mine.
Well, yeah. Tell him I said hello, and then he'll say, who? And it's okay. I don't need to know that. But we were at the, up in Northern California at their site for their conferences. And John Perkins is a guru. He's an ascended master. He's just all that. And what I said to him is, hey, John, thanks for that book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It truly put me into the conspiracy theory category officially. And he started laughing, but he is something else. And he has a love summit, which I knew nothing about, and I'm going to look into, because we really do need to be talking about love in this very hateful environment that the press continues to promulgate and promote, and get back to these conversations. So we are at the end of our time, and this doesn't happen to me a lot, but it's like, could we just start our own talk show, Marcy, and get on the podcast seat every week, because there's so much more to share. And as you know, our mission with Mrs. Green's World is really to raise the consciousness about the biggest threat our country, our world, our planet has ever faced, and that is of climate change. It knows no economic boundaries. It knows no political parties, and it isn't coming. It's happening now. We're talking about climate adaptation. And my final words are, please get this book, because you'll thank me. You'll thank me for bringing it into your world. You'll thank Marcy for her passion, her commitment, her creativity, her fun in making you want to turn the next page and become part of this very, very important movement. And I'm honored that you spent an hour with us, Marcy. I'll continue to watch what you're doing and what you're up to. And I'm so pleased that you got to be with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. You know, I'm always just reminding people, if you're not a part of the solution, you're a part of the problem. And it actually is very easy to be a part of the solution, and very exciting and fun and empowering, because, you know, we all want to do good. We all want to be connected to each other, you know, and this movement, this eco-renaissance, is, it's accessible, it's affordable, it's authentic. It is the way of the future. It is the only way of the future. And so obviously, you know, people can get more information about, you know, my brands and my work on my website at marcyzaroff.com, and follow me on Instagram at marcyzaroff, and hopefully send me your feedback about the book, because I thank you. I loved hearing your feedback.
And I will commit fantastic. I'll commit to writing a review, because I know that matters. And I like to remind all of our listeners that links to all of this will be on the page when we put the podcast up. Links to Marcy's, her website and all of her social media connections, and pretty much anything we mention, Kelly does the research and puts a link to it so that people don't have to be writing things down if they're driving in the car. We like to do that work for you. And I'm going to have her add the Love Summit, because I want to find out what's up with that and how do I get to go to that. It's been an incredible year. But I'd like to just tell everybody that we've got great shows lined up, not just for this month, but for this year. On January 17th, you know our commitment to thinking globally and acting locally. So on our local show, we're going to have Danny Nee and Mike Peel talking about the Community Investment Corporation and Local First, indeed a winning combination. And on our January 22nd show, when I thought, Marcy, you would find this quite interesting, is Mika Hollander, and she's the co-founder and CEO of Sustain Natural. And for the very first time, we are going to be talking about feminine hygiene products, educating people and closing the toxic loop. So I can't wait for that. So you're laughing.
I love Mika. And her father, Jeff, is the founder of Seventh Generation. Yeah, so it's fun to see, you know, them in partnership on such a cutting-edge company and having so much fun with it, but it's so important. So
we thought it was a perfect second show follow-up to what you're doing, because it's certainly a part of it, and it's really disgusting what we have been able to, because of lack of policy, put in our bodies, and the impact of all of that horror on our health. So, Marcy Zaroff, thank you for showing up in my life oh so long ago, and keep on doing what you're doing and inspiring all of us to know better and do better. Thanks.
Thank you. And I hope we can all co-create, you know, a stylish, sexy, and sustainable world. So, thank you for having me today.
Thanks, Marcy.
Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.